Hello and welcome everyone to Pixels and Ink, these from ICG Magazine. Wow, that was off to a great start. Today we're joined by a full cast, including Chris DeHoog.
Hello.
Jordan Biotti.
Hello.
And Hayes Madsen. Is that right?
Yep, you got it.
Cool. Look at that. Didn't screw up that badly today. So today we're going to be touching on one of the biggest games of the year, Final Fantasy 16, and most of the cast has played some of it. After that, we're going to touch on the latest Nintendo Direct, including all the big announcements that kind of rehashed from Summer Game Fest. So without any further ado, let's jump into some Final Fantasy discussions with Chris.
It's icon time. Yeah. Where to start even? Yeah. So the review went up today as a recording. Or no, yesterday, sorry. Today's the day. Yeah, time is a weird soup. And
round flat circle. Yeah,
flat circle. Weird soup. It's all kinds of spoopy things. Mm-hmm. In my 2.5 years here, I have given out 2 perfect 10s, and this earned it pretty handily. I don't even know where to start, really, honestly. It's just I'm still kind of floored by the ending of it and the whole experience and all that.
Why did this one deserve a perfect 10 when you've given out so few in your history here?
It's just an escalation of everything. Like on one hand, it does a lot of things that Final Fantasy hasn't done in a long time. Like for me, as a longtime fan with the series, I haven't felt this strongly about a Final Fantasy since like 10, 20 years ago, 22 years ago. The presentation, the writing and all that stuff, the cohesiveness of the plot is all just top shelf. And the presentation is visually is just stunning between the score and the graphics and how it utilizes all the power of the PS5. I'm not the kind to cry at games, but like at the end there, I was like, if I did, I would be weeping open, like at several points throughout this game. Just a raw performance. And yeah,
I do cry. I'd say relatively frequently at certain games. So the fact that you said that pretty much confirms that I'm probably going to cry at the end of this.
Yeah. I'm also the kind to cry at games, and I cried, I think, maybe a half dozen times. Not like full on cry every time, but at least a little bit.
Yeah.
No, Hayes, side quests even that made me cry.
And Hayes, you also gave it a perfect score. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. For Twinfinite.
And why was that? Why did you give it the perfect score?
Yeah, I kind of, when I put out my review, I kind of had like a thing where I had 3 points that were basically why I did it. One is the side quests.
Right.
I think the side quests in this are exceptional narratively, in terms of the story that they tell and the way that they enhance the world and kind of bring these characters to the forefront is really great. Even if like mechanically they're not the most interesting side quests. The second is the combat system. I think the way the combat system grows across the experience is something pretty incredible. It's similar to something like Devil May Cry 5, but with more progression in a way. That combat starts out simple, but the more I got into that game, it's just like every few hours it would enhance in some way. And there's just, it's so robust in terms of the options it affords you. And then the third is the icon battles, which I think everyone is going to agree are the highlight of this game.
And what are the icon battles, just for anyone that has not yet played the game?
Yeah, so there are these, you know, the summon monsters of past Final Fantasy games like Phoenix and Titan and Shiva. In this game, they play like a very direct role in the story. So most of the main characters are what is called a dominant, so they can bring out the power of an icon and turn into these giant summon monsters.
Rather than you just summon them to help you.
Yes. So you have multiple like boss battles across the game where you are turning into Ifrit and you're fighting different, you know, icons. And I honestly think they might be the best boss battles I've ever seen in a video game.
That's really cool.
Yeah, they're a neat mix because on paper they're pretty simple, right? Like it's so at times it creates basically like different version of Clive, the main character, and that you have like the same kind of control schemes and stuff like that. And the other half of them are just kind of quick time events, but they are some of the most intense experiences I've had in games for the past, I don't even know how long. Like, there's a couple of them later on in the game where I wanted to like run around my living room in circles, 'cause I was just so like hyped up by it. But yeah, if you look at it on paper, it's just like, hey, it's a quick time event. We've had these for a long time, but something about them is the intensity is just cranked up to 11.
Yeah.
Cause I mean like playing the demo, at least, I felt that the first one felt a little guided, but I think that's done very deliberately. Because it's just, it is trying to get like give you like just like a basic understanding of it. So like, despite the fact that it was very just like, you know, you're flying around as the Phoenix and it's just like, you know, wait, like very, very telegraph dodge. Okay, now just like spam attack, very telegraph dodge. Mm-hmm. But like to both Hayes and Chris's point, it was so intense and so like well paced and with everything. And I said this last week, like with the music, the style, just everything that was going on, like I did not care. Like it was so much fun.
Right.
I think go ahead.
No, please. I was going to ask a question, but if you have something more to say, please.
Yeah. One thing that's very interesting is as a huge 14 player, you know, Creative Business Unit 3 has been doing these kind of massive scale boss battles for years, but in that MMO format. And it's kind of cool to see them bring that expertise into a single player action game, because there's a lot of similarities between the two games in terms of how these boss battles are pitched and how they play out and the scale of them. So it's just something very cool to see the like similarities between the two.
Now, a lot of people might not know the MMO, the Final Fantasy XIV, but a lot of people did play the last main entry. How does it compare to that? And what really does this entry do differently that makes it so exciting?
A lot. So 15.
Does it not turn into a hallway at the midpoint? Because that would be a big step in the right direction.
So 15, if you haven't played it, Final Fantasy 15 was the first open world entry in the series, and which was one thing on paper, which is fine. You know, it's worth an experiment. It turned out that they also chopped a bunch of the story off of the core experience and shoved it into a CG movie. And then they just dropped a bunch of the DLC they were going to do. And
the CG was a bit of a mess. Aaron Paul in it, right?
Aaron Paul, Sean Bean, and Game of Thrones Lena Headey.
Which is so weird. Kind of funny in retrospect now.
It's bizarre in retrospect.
Well, originally the 15 hat was going to be also Final Fantasy versus 13.
Yeah, so that was a game that spent like 6 years in development hell, never really materialized in a playable form, but they kept showing it off. And they're like, oh, oops, it's 15 now. And it was like half the story that people were expecting.
Right.
So in that regard, 16 is by comparison a vastly different game in that it is very cohesive. It is very complete. In fact, it's probably one of the more cohesive like JRPGs that I've played forever. Usually like around the halfway point, you're like, this is getting kind of soupy. You're like, you're throwing a lot of metaphysical stuff out there and it's getting kind of hard to maintain the through line. But this one, it was like right up to the very end, I had a very clear picture of what was going on. There was a like scaffolding of the goals of the whole story and it all built to a great point. 15 was a bit of a mess in that you could, hey, you know, you're the prince in exile basically, and you're supposed to go home and deal with all that crap, but let's go fishing instead. Like it couldn't be more different night and day. Not that I don't like 15, but this is just a different kind of monster altogether.
One thing I think is interesting about 16 story, you know, a lot of the marketing has very much leaned into this kind of like Game of Thrones inspiration of this dark fantasy political world, a revenge story. But without spoiling anything, you know, that kind of theming really is only there for maybe the first half of the game. And then the second half really kind of veers into like traditional Final Fantasy, like weird sci-fi and fantasy kind of stuff. And I think it all still works. You know, the shift is done well, but I think a lot of people were expecting this to just be like, oh, it's just Final Fantasy Game of Thrones. And it is in there, but a lot of what this game does is still feels very traditional Final Fantasy.
Yeah, now, like there's a lot of moments where I felt like, you know, the exploration kind of reminded me of Final Fantasy X in some ways, because it's not like the most robust. It's not open world like 15 was, but it was very open environments, some kind of more narrow environments, because it's an RPG. It's a single player game. You're still going to have some kind of narrow focus unless you're doing a full-fledged open world thing. But yeah, like the Game of Thrones influence, I felt it really strong in the first couple hours, especially in like the scope of the demo. And I saw some reactions to the demo after I'd already gotten much farther in the game. And I was like, no, just be patient. They're going kind of hard at the start with a lot of like F-bombs. There's a lot of like, there's a couple sex scenes even in the like, or sex-ish scenes towards the start.
Okay, that seems weird for a Final Fantasy game, I have to say.
There are some weird sex scenes in this game.
It weirded me out a little bit.
Okay.
And even like the really violent, visceral end of the demo, like that doesn't really happen again on the same level. Weird. Like that is very much the darkest point, I would say. There are some other dark points, but that is like, that was an uncomfortable moment to watch and it doesn't go that far again.
It's something I felt like, and I think it like, it harkened back to feelings I had whilst playing Triangle Strategy. It's like,
yes, that game. Let's bring that one up again.
I was about to make the joke that like Square Enix already did Final Fantasy Game of Thrones and it was called Triangle Strategy, and in both cases like it wasn't the best, and it feels to me like someone who maybe half remembers the first season of Game of Thrones, because even in the demo like everything is so telegraphed, like that one the Clive's mom, like the minute you see her right away, I was like, okay, she's clearly going to betray everybody. Like they're giving her like evil face. All they have to do is give her like sinister music and a shifty eyed dog. And it's like to complete the whole circle. It's like, how did we not see this?
Clive's mom is just literally the worst.
She's the worst. And it took five seconds to figure that out.
She's like a weird mix of like Catelyn Stark and Cersei Lannister at the start of the game.
That's very strange.
Clive's kind of in like the Jon Snow kind of route. He even has the wolf and all that stuff.
I definitely saw that. Yeah.
But like I was saying though, it definitely tapers off and then you get into more of that fantasy type.
I don't know if you agree, Chris, but I think there's actually quite a lot of humor in this game. Like it gets pretty funny at points. There's one character that's Clive's uncle who is he is one of the funniest Final Fantasy characters I've ever seen. There's every scene he's in, he's just this larger than life, like galumphy kind of guy, kind of like Gallif in Final Fantasy V.
Yeah, that's a good comparison, actually. Yeah. And Clive himself is pretty funny. Like, there's a lot of good one-liners, even like, you know, on side quests and stuff like that. When you're hunting marks and stuff, after you beat like a big monster, like you'll have some kind of one-shot comment. I'm going to caveat this by saying I liked Forspoken, but it's like the opposite of that. Like it wasn't trying too hard. It was just enough. It was just like, he says one thing and it's just like, that's great. And you just move on. You don't have to dwell on it.
it's cool. It's good to hear that like too, because like, I feel like for quite a while with Final Fantasy, like main characters, they've all been sort of like brood lords. Like even like Noctis, like didn't really like crack wise. He had like three of his bros to do that for him. Titus was just the worst. Squall wasn't like the jokiest. I never played 9, so I don't know.
Zidane was very jokey. Yeah,
Zidane is
okay. Yeah, like, yeah, because the whole vibe is very light on that game too. The whole style, everything is like, a little more friendly. But yeah,
I tend to like the Broodlord characters. Clive's in that camp, but he's not without, you know, a little bit of mirth now and then. And for him, it's just Ben Starr. I keep praising this performance, but like it really tied everything together. Like the performance he gives, even like straight down just to like the like incidental voice lines and everything, every single line, he's just absolutely giving it all. And it really added a lot of depth to him. Like, you feel his rage. It is very genuine. His grief is very genuine. Everything comes across very solidly. Yeah, it's like, but like during his big defiant speeches, like I'm like, yeah, let's go, let's fight right now. Like I'm right there with you. Like I'm on the cause.
Now, just to start, just going to touch on, I know there's been a lot of talk about the new direction of this game and the people behind it. Could you kind of go into how do you think that really changed the output of what people get? Director,
you want to take first crack at this, Hayes? Because I've been taking all the first.
Yeah, you know, I think to a lot of people, Naoki Yoshida and his team at CBU3, like a lot of people see them as the team that has kind of saved Final Fantasy. And there's truth to that, because without the success of 14, I don't know that we would still have Final Fantasy, just because of a financial situation. And to me, it's clear that what I like the most about what Yoshida has done with the series is that it seems like he understands that Final Fantasy is just this broad idea. Like, there's not a box that a Final Fantasy game has to fit in. And I think that's what 16 does. It really kind of tries a lot of new things and, for the most part, succeeds in pretty much every way. You know, it's got this more mature tone that works for it. This action combat system that is one of the best that I've ever played. And, just the general feeling of it, Final Fantasy hasn't felt this fresh in a long time. And I think, like Chris said, I think the last time a Final Fantasy game really felt this vibrant and this new was probably 10. You know, not that there haven't been fantastic games in there, 14 included, but this just feels like a breath of fresh air.
It's awesome.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Like, I love 12, 13, even 15 for what it is. Like, it's not the best Final Fantasy, but I still really enjoyed it. But yeah, Yoshida's team just really drove it out of the park with this one. I like Ben Sir, every time I hear Yoshida talk, I gain a little more respect for him. He's just got a really humble personality, and he totally understands the franchise. Like you said, it doesn't have to keep... There's not one box you can put it in. That's always been its defining thing. From the very first game, like from the very first sequel, it changed everything. It made something new while keeping, you know, one foot in familiar territory, one foot in new ground. The other thing I would add, I actually add about the development team is that Michael Christopher Koji Fox was the localization director. And he also works with Yoshida on 14. I think that made a huge difference in the way that he approached this project. Like they said, they wanted him to kind of put the English first perspective on it. So everything was kind of written English first. And I think that kind of helped the cohesiveness that I was talking about earlier. Because like normally we get JRPGs translated, obviously. But just like the vision he had for it and the way that it all kind of executed, like the way they built it this way, when the leading inspirations like Game of Thrones and stuff like that, to kind of that like from an English first perspective and then translate it to other things, to the point where even like Yoshida's like, yeah, play in English with dub with subtitles. Mm-hmm. English is the defined way. Not that it's better because it's English first, but just the way that they approached it with Koji Fox's direction, I think made a huge difference as well. That's one of the things I think that's kind of giving it a really strong reception in the West, at least.
Yeah. The one other thing that we haven't really touched on that I think I want to highlight is the soundtrack of this game is just utterly incredible. Like, the music enhances this game in every aspect. Masayoshi Soken also does the music for 14. And the thing with his music 14 and this is it's just so eclectic. Like, you have these grand opera pieces or these like sweeping orchestral pieces, and then the next minute you'll have this like heavy metal rock track with rap over it for a boss battle.
I mean, why wouldn't
it's just so weird? But I mean, he really has done a phenomenal job of highlighting and bringing out the emotion in these like big story scenes.
Yeah, I totally agree with that too. Like, the one thing I would note about the music is that, like, there was times early on where I was like, why isn't there music playing? There was a lot of like silent scenes, which I found kind of weird for Final Fantasy at first bit, because, like, you know, I'm still in the brain of like Uematsu is Final Fantasy music, and right. you know, he's been gone for half the series now, but I still have that kind of hardwired, like, oh, every scene should have this like amazing bopping score behind it. But that actually was kind of a powerful decision, I thought, in retrospect. It was as jarring as I found it at first. It's like, well, this actually lets you focus on the moment. And then, yeah, once the music does really kick in, though, like, again, part of the reason for those icon battles being so intense, I think, is that score.
Right.
It's like the familiar theme that kind of what they did with 15, where you had like the main apocalypse theme, they called it. And they kind of got recycled through the different summon battles. It's kind of a similar approach here, but it's just the way that they customize it to each battle just adds so much more personality and spectacle to each individual fight, a lot of personality.
Yeah.
And so yeah, not quite as eclectic as 14 score. There's no Lahi or anything on it, but
Sokken talked about in a Game Informer interview at their cover story that like he didn't make one main theme for this game, but basically every character kind of has their own musical motif that gets looped in their story moments and the scenes they're in.
I was about to say that. I was thinking about that now, like in at least like, cause the demo is really just the, like the opening moments of the game. Right. And like, so when it starts on that kind of like battle and Clive and like and his crew are kind of like looking at it, there's this really like intense operatic score that like really fits the intensity of the coming battle. But then I could hear the familiar notes of the Final Fantasy theme. I genuinely like had a jaw drop. I was like, how did they incorporate this so well? Like,
yeah. That's right. Yeah. It's interesting you say that actually, because for people who are like longtime fans, you'll notice there are themes from like a few different Final Fantasy games that get worked into the music. There's like the Warrior of Lights theme from 1. There's themes from 4 that get worked in. It's really interesting that there's
for some reason.
it's all very
Final Boss battles. One Wing Angel. like no one was gonna notice.
there's a couple songs on here. I think that might be Soken's One Wing Angel. Actually, yeah.
Yeah.
The icon nice. Battle themes. Yeah, and there's a couple times even like where the main series theme comes in and it's used really well. There's a couple different arrangements that are used throughout, and every single time they come in, if I cried at games, I would be like amazing job on that for sure.
Now I do want to quickly touch on the fact that Final Fantasy is one of the series that is one of the most beloved JRPGs that are out there, really. Do you see this new entry kind of expanding that market, kind of just playing into people that already like Final Fantasy? Where is this one sitting in the pantheon?
I think it has a good chance of doing that for sure. They made a big push throughout the marketing of like, you don't have to play the first 15 games to enjoy this one. Like, so many things. Games. Yeah, right? It sounds daunting, right? Oh, Final Fantasy 16. Games. Yeah. Then later on, the marketing, like towards launch, started to shift towards like, hey, start here. This is like your way in. Mm-hmm. I've seen through the community people start with every conceivable entry point. Like, I've heard people who started by watching the Final Fantasy VII Advent Children movie with no context of the original game,
right?
And getting sucked into the whole series from there. Longtime fans didn't love Final Fantasy XV. There's a lot of people that came into that as the first entry and then worked backwards. I think, yeah, this one has a strong potential to do the same thing because it is such a solid foundation. Might be a little more jarring because everything else is a little more turn-based as you go further back.
Right.
This is very much an outlier in gameplay, but I think the universality of some of the themes of the story will help with that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It seems like
Go ahead. No, you're good. I was just gonna agree. You're good.
Oh well, yeah, because it seems like you know, with everything they're doing, and I was just thinking about it like as we were talking, like with this kind of push towards not streamlining in a sense that it like dumbs things down. Like I was thinking about Street Fighter VI, and I didn't realize because I hadn't really been following it, because like, you know, just the way like fighting games are, you know, it's they are kind of abrasive, so I haven't really been like keeping up with all the Street Fighters or Mortal Kombat's or anything like that. So I was unaware that Street Fighter 6 had like a modern control scheme that just makes it more or less play like Smash Bros. And it's like, I've been seeing story after story after story of people who were like, I couldn't get into Street Fighter because it was too like restrictive to play. And now like, I love Street Fighter. And playing 16, like even as a longtime Final Fantasy fan myself, like playing 16 definitely does feel like the kind of game where it's like they've brought it into the modern era in such a way, like almost like with the Final Fantasy VII remake, like they've updated the combat, they've updated the controls, they've made things feel a lot better to play and a lot easier to understand. You know, they added accessibility options, you know, like, and not only that, even with story, because early Final Fantasy and even like kind of across the spectrum does feel very like, grandiose and high concept, and much in the way like you know, when you compare something like in terms of getting people into like the fantasy genre, like the way you have like Lord of the Rings, which is like this very like big story with like elves and wizards of great import, and then you look at Game of Thrones, which is hot fantasy that fucks. Like that's kind of what this feels like. Like, and I kept thinking of that joke whilst like playing the opening hours of the demo. Like I'm like, this is hot Final Fantasy that fucks, like, because it really does feel that way. And it's definitely going to bring in a new like audience that really never like engaged with Final Fantasy in that way, because it seemed like, oh, that's for nerds, but this is the cool version of Final Fantasy.
There's one quote that's going to go in the Accolades trailer. Final Fantasy that fucks. CG Magazine.
Now I wanted this. Final Fantasy. This up to release, there was a lot of comparisons between this and Elden Ring. Were those kind of unfounded? Is there some truth to that? And how much so, if so?
I think the only real comparison is that they're both fantasy, and that's pretty much as far as it goes, honestly. They're completely diametrically opposed games.
Why did that comparison kind of go? Just because they're both Japanese-made fantasy games? That about it?
But it's the Elden Ring vacuum, right? Like everything gets pulled into its orbit, right?
Right.
I can kind of see that point in the same way that people kind of said, like, you know, if you can't get into Dark Souls, Elden Ring is the game to play because, like, it's a lot, like, it's easier to get into, like, it's not as punishing, like, even though it is essentially Dark Souls. Like there are a lot more ways to approach it, and like it kind of like, you know, it had such a tailwind that even people who really weren't like big Dark Souls fans kind of did end up like gravitating towards it. So I can kind of see that comparison in the same way that like this Final Fantasy, like with everything it's done, does make things a lot faster, a lot more action focused, and like Chris was saying, like if you weren't really into turn-based RPGs, like this is the Final Fantasy that's kind of like, okay, well, we're not doing any of that. Like it's action, it's intense, but it still does feel like at its core like a Final Fantasy game.
Right.
Yeah, one thing that kind of just jogged me there, one comparison I could make is that like Elden Ring, there are a lot of ways to customize the way that you play. In the sense that as you go on, Clive has the ability to use different abilities from icons. So you'll, as you go on, you get a vast suite of iconic abilities you can customize your loadout with. I was experimenting with that on and off until the very end. And one change I made right before I went to the final boss was like clicked. Everything clicked. I'm like, yeah, this is my ideal thing right here. I could see people having vastly different experiences with the gameplay just by using different sets throughout the game. So that is one way I would say it is comparable. Maybe the only way.
Fair enough.
Well, Chris, one other thing I did see mentioned too was that people wish the active time lore system in 16 was in Elden Ring. Because 16 has this cool system called the Active Time Lore, where during a cutscene, you can press the touchpad on the PS5 controller. It pauses the scene. It brings up like, hey, here's some context-sensitive like dictionary entries. Like if you need a reminder of what this means or who this person is.
That would make Elden Ring accessible. We can't have that.
No, that would get no.
I do think that kind of thing would maybe go against the way From designs their worlds,
yes,
though.
Yes,
yeah. Exactly. From very much wants you to like. They want you to spend those hours digging into lore and figuring it out. Like they
don't reading wanna, descriptions of things, yeah, for some reason.
They don't want to put it on a platter. You gotta look for it.
Yeah, you gotta work for it. And that's, you know, it adds a little bit to the mystery of the, because mm-hmm, that's you know, again, you're comparing apples to oranges, because like that's the way From designs their entire worlds, is that they're just shrouded in mystery, right? So it's like it really is up to you to sort of like put things together and fill in the gaps with your own sort of interpretation. But I was going to say, like, as much as I actually like did appreciate the active time lore thing, like, I don't know, there was a part of me that cringed a little bit that you could stop a cutscene to like read up on the lore. And I think it's maybe me as I'm getting a little bit older. Cause I kind of felt like even with Not just this game, but like other games recently, a little bit more like heavy RPGs. Like I am getting a little bit tired of like how often a game will stop you for a cutscene for like information that could just be given to you during gameplay. And maybe it was just, again, like I don't know, because it's like it was just the demo was, you know, the first like 3 hours of the game. So like things could, I don't know how things will evolve, but it really did feel like just in that opening sequence, it was just like, right, like it was like, you know, walk to a spot, cutscene, walk to somewhere else, cutscene. Like, and I was just like, can we not incorporate this into gameplay somehow? Like, why do we just stop every 5 seconds to watch like information that could just be given to you while you're playing? Like, and I think it's just me. I'm getting older. I'm getting more sensitive about how much time I have left.
You cranky, Jordan? Also, what?
My that mortality is...
Yeah,
like, is
yeah, that extra 10 minutes makes such a difference.
There's at least some people like you on this crap. I go off about mortality. no, so to that point, though, yeah, the opening is a little kind of like...
It's very cutscene.
You walk 5 feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That, again,
it does get balanced out more.
Yeah.
That too. And also with the active time lore, it's there if you need it. It's not, you don't have to use it.
Yeah, it's optional. Yeah.
But it was kind of nice knowing it was there.
This is a story that I think you can at least understand just by playing it. If you want to get more, you can. Mm-hmm. It's not like, and I will also give a caveat, I like Final Fantasy 13, but that story is just impenetrable.
It's a mess.
Like,
bonkers. It is bananas.
Yeah, the Eyes of Time lore system and the lore, there's an NPC in your hideaway, like your base, that keeps like the full dictionary of stuff. You can go check everything out. That system combined is Final Fantasy 13's data logs if they were good. Like the data logs on 13 were a mess. They shoved a bunch of important stuff in there. It was totally impenetrable.
I tried playing 13 and there was a lot going on.
Just a lot.
There's a lot of proper nouns in that game.
Yeah, there's things. Okay. I know we want to avoid spoiler talk. So, what you're trying to sell someone on this game? How would you sell them? And why do you think people should go out and buy this game on when it's available? Whenever you can kind of get your hands on it.
Well, I think for starters, we've already worked at selling the game, because I believe in the course of this chat, we've sold at least 2 copies.
Yeah. No, you know what? No, I bought mine before podcast. I didn't realize it was like already out. I thought it came out tomorrow. So I was just like, because actually, funny enough, I went on to PSN looking for Street Fighter 6 and I was like, should I get this game? And then I saw like the thing that was just like Final Fantasy 16 out now. I was like, okay, done.
Okay. Our stock has been going up. There's at least one person has bought it from the team while we've been chatting. As far as selling points, I mean my 3 points are that it's got an amazing story. It's a beautiful, heart-rending story that will send you on a roller coaster of all the emotions. Mm-hmm. The gameplay is just it's great. It's a great system in that it's deep and customizable. But you can make it easier if you're, again, a turn-based fan who doesn't play action RPGs at all.
It's crazy.
It's the antithesis of like Elden Ring, in that it's an accessible, customizable action system that you can get into if you're not that type of gamer.
Yeah.
And the presentation is just, I mean, this is next gen. This feels 100% next gen. Mm. Those are my three big points personally.
Yeah, I think I would agree pretty much with everything. And to me, like, the big thing with this is the approachability of it. This game wants you to enjoy it, and it takes liberal steps to, you know, kind of provide options for players of all different skills. And I think this, I honestly think this would even be a good, like, introduction to character action games. You know, I think this would be a good place for people to start. And then if they like it, maybe move on to, like, Devil May Cry and God of War and things like that. So not only is it a good introduction to Final Fantasy, but I think just action in general, it's kind of a good starting point for that.
Right.
Can I just pick your brain for a second, Hayes? What were some of the kind of, like, negative things? Like, do you have any, like, negatives about the game at all? Because, like, I feel like people are praising it a lot universally.
You gave it 10 out of 10, guys. You don't get to have negatives.
10 out of 10? No, I'm joking. No, the game is perfect.
I'm joking. It's just
to me, this was a case of where what the game did well so overshadowed the problems. But I do think it has problems. I think the side quests are not interesting in terms of objectives. Like, they're all interesting in terms of narrative and story, but you're doing the same: fight the enemies, go find these items, go talk to this person. It feels very MMO-ish. So I think that could have been improved. I think the story has some good themes overall, but there is some weirdness with, you know, the comments that they made on diversity. And then you go into this and they're telling a story that pretty heavily talks about slavery in some ways. So I don't think that's necessarily a huge issue, but I think it's something that needs to be talked about, just how they approach diversity to this game. But overall, I do think that what this game does well, how it redefines the series, how it pushes it forward, all of that is so good, you know?
Yeah, that was definitely, it's kind of a Dan if you do, Dan if you don't situation, right? Like, if you put, like, POC characters into a game about slavery and you have them involved in the slavery, you're going to have backlash to that. If you don't have them, they got backlash. You can't tread into those waters without, you know, taking on some water yourself. Like, you can't avoid it. Not that they didn't do a good job of dealing with those themes, but I can see how they would have wanted to avoid sending, you know, messages or ugly imagery. That's great points there too. I mean, my only really complaints were, like, gameplay related. Like you said, the quests do get kind of bog standard RPG towards the end in terms of objectives, but I was so compelled by, like, you know, they do a very good job of making you feel like they're important to do. But at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, you are still going over there, killing that guy and coming back.
But just like to that point, like, you know, that isn't such an issue for, I guess, maybe, like, for me, because I do like, to a certain degree, a little bit of, like the ability to kind of, like, tune out for a bit. You know, so, like, because, like, recently I started actually getting into, because I only played, like, the first mission of Miles Morales, and I was waiting for the PS5 version. So it's like there's a lot of times where you just want to kind of, like, you know, throw on, like, a podcast, whatever, swing around the city, beat up some thugs, and have to really engage with the story. So, like not, you know, when you play something like The Witcher 3, for example, where, you know, every side quest, you know, really, if it's going to evolve into some crazy adventure, right? Like, they did, CD Projekt Red really put a lot of time and care into their side quests. Not to say that Final Fantasy 16 doesn't, but it is nice to have that kind of thing where it's like, you know, if I really want to get into this super intense story that I need to, like, really focus on, and, you know, turn off all other media to be engaged in, like, that's great. If, you know, I have a couple, like, you know, just repetitive, whatever, go here, kill a guy missions, and it's not just, like, going to the same cave every single time, like in Skyrim, you know, even though Skyrim's okay for that too, like, if you want to just be bored for an hour. Like, it is nice to have that variety, because at the end of the day, it's a lot more action-y, right? Like, so, like, it is nice to just sort of have those kind of just, like, moments where you can just have action.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, like other publications were harder on the game for that. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of speaks to, like, you know, I appreciated that this time there were side quests that felt relevant. You know, they might not have been the most stimulating gameplay wise, and that was kind of like, oh, okay, I'm still going on a fetch quest or like a kill X enemies quest, but the ramifications made it worthwhile for me, and it kind of plays into that pacing thing you're talking about as well, Jordan. Like, as much as I wanted to press on with the story, I was like, no, I need to go do all these side quests. People are counting on Clive and all this stuff. So kind of a mixed bag there. And that's why I didn't personally take notes off for it, because I thought it was worthwhile in the end.
Well, it's weird. And it's also a little weird to me to hear that, like, other publications were knocking it for it, because I really don't remember people knocking 15 for its pretty, like, garbage side quests. Like,
15 got knocked for a fair number of things.
Good luck for a fair amount, sure, but I don't remember anyone ever saying, like, you know, why the hell are these guys going on a quest for goddamn cup noodles? Like,
I do remember some people talking about side quests with Seven Remake, though, and how kind of have these innocuous side quests that land at times where you're like, feels like you should really be focusing on something more important.
Should I go over there?
You know what? And I'll cop to that too, because with the Seven Remake. And maybe this is just, like, again, like, fondness for Seven and, like, you know, nostalgia, just remembering it a different way. Like, it does kind of feel like, because, you know, in the opening moments of Seven, the original, like, it's paced so well, and there's a very clear goal, like, what these guys are trying to achieve in that opening section. And it is kind of undercut, and it does feel very padded when it's like, okay, we're still going to go and, like, bomb a building, but let's stop for 5 seconds to find someone's cat. Like, this is what Cloud was up to, right? Like,
ultimately, to me, why those side quests, why it didn't really affect my opinion overall of the game, is because they are side quests. Like, it's not something you have to engage with. If you don't find it interesting, if you don't find it engaging, you can just move on and just stick with the main story. But like Chris said, I think, to me, the way that those stories tie in, the way that the side quests tie into the overall narrative is what really sold me on it. I can't imagine some of the side quests at the end of the game. I can't imagine not having played those, because
I was thinking the same thing.
Really big, big, big stuff that happens.
I'm actually very curious to see how it changes at all if you haven't done those things, because there's, like, the side quests all have ramifications for the movement that you're part of, like. And then I can't imagine the movement succeeding without any part of those in place, right? It's just if you want to speed through the game, it's about 30 hours if you don't do that stuff. But I did every single side quest I could find and got 60 hours out of it and quite loved every minute of it. So the other thing I was gonna mention is kind of like a gameplay flaw, is that I felt like my companions weren't doing a whole lot. I always felt like I was like, yeah, there's times where, like, they're not really doing anything. But later on, they get better abilities, and I started to notice that, like, while I'm over here wailing on these guys, they're off to the side doing something else, and you just don't feel that they're relevant, which at times was annoying, but then I started to kind of get perspective on that as well. That and the crafting system was kind of, like, wishy-washy. It was just mostly automatic and didn't really make a huge difference. But
the crafting system, I think, is maybe one of the bigger flaws, just because you get all these materials, but at any given time, you're not going to craft more than one thing until the next thing unlocks in the story. So there's not a lot of variation there. Yeah. But again, I think that's
obligatory at this point now.
Like, I think that's offset by how much variety the icon abilities give you.
Yes, definitely. Your equipment is definitely second base to those, I would say.
Right. Well, with that, are we ready to move on to our next topic? Talk about some Nintendo. Yeah. I mean, unless there's anything you want to wrap up with before we move on?
It's icon time.
Okay. I think we've covered it. Sounds good. Okay, so Nintendo, if anyone does not know, Nintendo had a Direct that kind of tangentially followed all the events of Summer Game Fest. So they announced a lot of things that seemed like they were kind of trailing on what Microsoft or Sony or just the event itself had. But they brought some new items to the table. So let's dive in. Jordan, do you want to take this one away? I know you love this one.
Yeah, I was I was pretty happy with this one. I like you said, Brendan, I think we all knew to a certain degree, like they were going to just confirm that there was certain like stuff that was going to like out of Summer Games Fest that was
Game Fest.
Game Fest. Yes. There were more than one game, just saying.
Just one fest.
Yeah, but it's a games fest, not game fests.
Yes, it does.
See? Dana gets it. So yeah, like Sonic Superstars, like obviously that was going to be there. So Pokemon Scarlet and Violet, we all know my thoughts on this. I couldn't care less. And I was laughing, like, watching the initial trailer, because I was like, I wonder if they like fixed everything, and you can see like the NPCs in the background of the DLC moving at like 5 frames a second, and I was like, nope. This is just more of the same. But I don't know, if because I don't know about Hayes, Chris, you cared more for Scarlet and Violet than I did, so
that's DLC? Not saying a whole lot. That being said, as much as you didn't care about it, you did beat the crap out of it.
You know what? It was some cost fallacy, man. I spent money and I spent time, and I had to at that point.
Yeah, I know.
That's what gamblers say.
I was in Brazil. I had nothing else.
I haven't dug into as much of it as I thought I was going to, but that being said, my wife, who is not a gamer, has absolutely devoured that game and moved on to the rest of the Switch library of Pokemon games. So there is some value in there. I am curious to see where the DLC goes, but for now it's like, yeah, this looks neat, but it's not really, I'm not chomping at the bit to get in there just yet.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think the Pokemon stuff pretty much got overshadowed by everything else that came out.
There was a lot of announcements.
For once that was nice.
It was really nice to see some deeper stuff on Detective Pikachu too. Like, I was really happy about that.
I actually,
Detective Pikachu 1 was such an underrated gem.
I'm very excited about Detective Pikachu 2 because, you know, that first Detective Pikachu game is a pretty simple puzzle game. It's not very complicated. But what I love about Detective Pikachu is that I think it's the most interesting setting that series has had in a long time, just because it really shows that idea of how Pokemon and humans would live together. Like, it really dives into like, what would it actually look like if you lived in a city with Pokemon? How would that work? And I think it does a really good job about that.
It's almost like the antithesis of like the Scarlet Violet idea. It's like, rather than making a big open world that's like just kind of feels empty and not really like fleshed out or lived in, they made a small environment that does feel very genuine and very like well put together. And I feel like that's a lot of the like sort of like spin-off-y Pokemon games are good like that.
For sure.
But I don't know why, like, I was kind of getting vibes too in that trailer, like if they learned or sort of borrowed anything from the Detective Pikachu movie, like to kind of like add to this and make it a little bit more like a little more like conversation, a little bit more like cinematic, you know, to use that word. I'm excited for it. It looks super good. Then you know, there was the announcement that made me squeal like an actual like child. And man, what a call out, because I was seeing not too long, like the day before, that there was that leaker that said that there was going to be like a new Mario and a remaster SNES game. And there was a part of me that was like, you know what, take these leaks with a grain of salt, is, you know, whatever, like, you know, a new Mario and a direct, I mean, who could possibly see that coming, right? Like, and man, they fucking nailed it. Like, Super Mario RPG remastered in like with new, like totally new graphics, new arts, kind of new art style, what looks like actual, like fully visualized cutscenes, everything you could possibly want to love. That game was like seminal to me growing up. That was the game. I played nothing but that game from like grade 4 all the way to grade 6. Like, I loved that game.
See, I've never actually played it because I didn't have a Super Nintendo at that time. Chris, and I've just been missing out on all these years.
It's very
trying to get a good used copy somewhere without going bankrupt.
And, I'm really interested.
So I'm very interested in this.
I'm really interested to see more of the art style, because to me it seems to kind of be, it's trying to emulate the concept art and kind of like the overworld art a little bit.
It does feel, I thought it when I was watching the trailer, it does feel a little weird because, yeah, like they're trying to go with like that kind of like very squished down way that Mario and gang looked in the game, but still make it like very high definition and very like detailed. So yeah, like it ends up feeling like you have all these characters who were kind of just like put in a press and like pushed into a game. I think it works because honestly, like, yeah, like weird was kind of like the theme of this project.
Just to kind of touch on the graphic style again too, how do you feel about the, like, in terms of like losing that kind of claymation sort of look to it? That's always been my kind of main takeaway from it, seeing it without playing it. The new one looks really, really clean. Do you think it's going to be a big difference? Or
you know what? Because I always thought that the original looked like similar, like looked very clean for a Super Nintendo game. And I think a lot of the way they achieved that was through kind of like trying to emulate 3D in certain ways and making things like kind of like spherical almost. So, I mean, personally, yeah, like personally, I never got the vibe or the sense that like that the game, even like in the box art and everything, like looked kind of like claymation. It just kind of looked like very early bad CGI. But when you're a kid, in the 90s, like that was like, wow, games look, they can look like this.
Hey, you would not have Final Fantasy Tactics and today's HD 2D graphics without this game, without Square Enix breaking.
That's what I mean. Like, it was genuinely ahead of its time. That's why, it's good to see, because I think the one character in that game that genuinely looked the weirdest was Bowser, because he really is, like, when you see him, he just looks like he's made up of circles.
He's too complex for that engine.
Now he actually looks really good. Like, he looks like the way he's supposed to look. I like it. I honestly think it works. It really is, because it reminds me a lot of the Link's Awakening remake, where it's just like putting that sheen, that polish on top of it, on top of an already good looking game, is only just going to make it like look better, and it's going to work really good on the Switch. It's going to, all the colors are going to shine, are going to pop through, because it's a very colorful, like, vibrant game. It's got a lot of weird settings. And to see it too, because depending on how they really, like, how they, I guess they changed the perspective. One of the things I really liked about Mario RPG was how everything did kind of feel like it was on a board, right? Like, you go into an area and you can see like where the land kind of like ends, and there's just like void, but it made everything feel very like, I don't know, whimsical in a way. Right. So I'm curious to see if they're going to go the extra step and really like flesh things out and, or just like tighten the perspective so you don't see the borders, just to make it feel more like enhanced and alive. The only thing I think that I thought that not like worried me, but you could kind of see where there was a little bit of a disconnect, was maybe the animation is a little too clean, because they showed that scene where Mario's in the throne room and he's kind of like explaining what happens to the Chancellor, and they did that thing in the SNES to, like, as kind of like a joke that Mario never speaks, so he'd like spin around really like two frames of animation and turn into like Bowser and then turn into the princess, and like he's just like like miming what's happening. But the way that they did it in this one, like, it's felt a lot slower, so what didn't have that like very like sort of slapsticky, fast moving storytelling that the original had. I'm sure it won't bother me that much, but it's just like, it's the little things.
Yeah, there's got to be moments that they can't quite pull off in a modern, top of the line engine. Yeah,
I wonder if this is. They haven't really said. I wonder if it's just a straight remake or if there's going to be anything enhanced.
I guess I'm hoping that there will be, because like even the Link's Awakening thing had like the little like the dungeon maker thing and certain dungeon Yeah, certain things were kind of just like, you know, streamlined a little bit and made a little bit easier to figure out. They expanded the seashell like quest thing to a couple more. Because initially what I was wondering was in the trailer itself, they didn't show Square Enix like logo at all. But on the Nintendo store page for it, Square Enix is listed. It says Nintendo / Square Enix.
Yeah, so they're in the credits for the trailer as well. I know Yoko Shimomura is also involved in the new one as well, and she's almost primarily a Square Enix composer.
This isn't a spoiler to anyone, but I guess except for you, Chris, but it's not really like a spoiler. The final boss from
the secret boss was the final boss
from Final Fantasy IV, Kulix.
Yeah.
And he was, so that's why I was like, okay, when I was watching the trailer and I didn't see that Square was involved, I was like, okay, like, are they going to replace Kulix now with a different boss? Like, are they going to add something else? Like, I hope that they do, but at the end of the day, if it's just a straight remake of Mario RPG, like enhanced on the Switch, I'll be happy with that.
Yeah.
I could easily see that changing for just simplicity. Because I think that's one of the things that's always held RPG back from being on Switch Online is that there is the complicated hairiness with the different companies involved. So I'm fully ready for them to cut Kulix or just totally change that somehow, take the music out or whatever. I'm prepared for that. But it would be nice to see it stick around. But, I think Link's Awakening is probably a really good comparison, actually. Yeah.
Yep.
But like I said, if Square actually is involved, then I don't see any reason why they couldn't keep them in there. Yeah.
It's like how much is what I'm curious about, right? Like they must be doing it with their blessing, but like how involved are Square Enix staff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like Square was like heavily involved in development, at least.
Yeah.
It could be wrong, but so far that's not really the vibe that the messaging has given off.
Yeah. What else, Jordan?
What else was there? Well, Pikmin 4 looked really cool.
It does look cool.
Pikmin 4 basically has the depths.
Yeah. It's just the cave level from the first game. So I initially I was kind of skeptical on Pikmin 4. The more I saw about it, the more I was just like, but again, like that might just be, you know, nostalgia for the first two because they're just such good games. Even Pikmin 3. Okay, I'll say Pikmin 3 I liked a lot. I felt like it was maybe just a little too short and a little too simplified. This one looks like a lot of fun. It looks like they've really expanded on a lot of the ideas Pikmin had. I like the idea that you can go out after dark, even like if it's just like an optional thing. I also kind of like that there isn't, at least that we know of, a time limit attached to it. As much as I did like that in Pikmin 1 and 2, like, because Pikmin 1, you can, if you know how to play that game, you can really bust it down in like 5 or 6 days and just get it done. And that adds to the strategy, I think, too. Like, if you just kind of like know how to like where things are, how to get things most effectively, like you can really almost like speed run those games. But I like that this does feel like it, you know, it kind of like plays into that vibe Nintendo's been having with some of these games for better or worse. You know, RE, my thoughts on Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom.
okay, so like, speaking of the first two games, they announced that they're coming out. Well, they're out now on Switch digitally, and they're having a physical version. I've never been into Pikmin; it's never really grabbed me. Sell me on the first two.
it's active real time strategy with like a lot of heart, a lot of really good design, and a lot of charm. Like, even just if you go back into the story, like, of how Miyamoto created it, like, you know, he was just tending his garden one day and he had this idea, like, what if the vegetables like came to life and started helping you like complete tasks? Like, it's super cute. And yeah, it's like it plays really well too. It's not overly complicated, right? You know, you get three different types of Pikmin. They each kind of do different things. They all have sort of like strengths and weaknesses. You really start to connect with them too. Like, even though they, like, to a certain degree, they are disposable, you don't really want them to be.
It's so almost really heartbreaking to, like, when you lose too many.
Oh my god! Yeah, the little ghosts go into the air, like you see their souls like leave their body. It's and for a GameCube era game, like it really was, it really pushed the limits of the hardware. It looked amazing. It still looks really good to this day. Like it holds up. Yeah, like, and so, you know, if you like that kind of sort of like easy to get into, not even necessarily like difficult to master, like it's easy to get into, it has the right amount of like of balance and strategy, a lot of like good creative bosses, it's a really good time. And two just expands it, makes it even bigger. They add more Pikmin, they add a second character, even though he's a bit of an asshole. I almost want to say it's baby's first RTS, or not even RTS, like ATS. But like that sounds denigrating. It's really not. Like it's a really good starting place
in a positive way. It's baby's yeah. first positive.
I was still a little kid. When Pikmin came out, I was what, maybe like 11, 12 years old, and
2001.
And I loved it. Yeah, and then you'd end to see, and then and speaking of other re-releases, seeing Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon coming out on Switch, like a nice sort of like cleaned up. I personally think that one's the best. I love that one. So I agree. And I kind of remember too, I think like a little while ago, just kind of like wondering to myself, like, why don't they like re-release it or do something like new with it? Because yeah, I thought Dark Moon was so much fun.
Speaking of re-releases, I have to give a shout out for Star Ocean Second Evolution R. Like straight up, I think Star Ocean 2 is one of the best games Square has ever made.
Mm-hmm.
But this HD 2D remake looks gorgeous, but it also looks like it's actively trying to fix some of the problems that game had, like the combat system and getting party members and like. Oh man, I was really impressed by that trailer.
Yeah,
that blew me away. Like, that's probably one of the only Enix games I played before the merger. Like, I never really gravitated towards Enix,
right?
Except for this one. I rented it several times, played as much as I could through the first half of the game. So seeing some of these locales like recreated in what is probably one of the cooler HD 2D styles I've seen too, because it's not just doing the same live Octopath level.
Yeah, it's design. 3D.
They got their own spin on it. Yeah.
There's some comparison screenshots out there that are just like mind blowing, because the jump that this game has had, even just like the verticality of the graphics is what impressed me, because you go to these big cities, but you know, the original game was this kind of like top down RPG, where even when you're in these big cities, they kind of feel limited. But with these new graphics, they built up these like giant skyscrapers that feel like these massive sci-fi cities.
With Last Star Ocean that came out in the fall, because they went back to this to Star Ocean 2 as inspiration for it.
Yeah.
And I feel like it was one of the better ones they've done. I've missed the last few Star Oceans, but from what I'm gathered,
it was a real
turn to form for them because they went back to this well. So I'm really excited to see them go back to it and make it accessible, because it's been kind of buried in the sands of time until recently. So yeah.
I'm a huge Star Ocean fan, and it's one of those series that's like, man, I wish more people liked this series, because I'm so into it.
I'll admit I'm in that camp. I've always like, I even remember like seeing it on like the shelf at like Blockbuster and always wanting to rent it, but I just never got around to it. It's like, I've always seen Star Ocean around and heard it's very good, but I just never got into it.
Yeah. Everything except the fifth one. Don't play
that. Okay.
Just one bad.
It was very much a case of, you could tell that game had a very limited budget and a very short development time.
Oh,
so fun. I think
I love when that happens.
That development team did not get to do nearly anything that they wanted to, and you can very much tell that game suffered for it.
That's too bad.
Yeesh. Well, and also speaking of, I guess not remasters but re-releases. Pretty cool to see the Metal Gear Solid like collection landing on the Switch. A little disappointed that they went with the PlayStation 1 version of Metal Gear Solid. I was hoping they would just do the Twin Snakes version.
That would be so complicated.
If it was just for the Switch one, that would have been cool.
Yeah,
that one's because that one has the licensing issues, because it was partially done with Nintendo and it was done with a studio that no longer exists, because that was made in by Silicon Knights.
Yep.
That's right. Silicon Knights did the home of CG Magazine currently, Silicon Knights.
They got they made Eternal Darkness. And then they got too scared of money and success, so they made Two Human.
That was gonna be a trilogy.
It was supposed to be a trilogy. That's right.
It was X-Men. Silicon Knights was in St. Catharines. Is that what you mean? Or yeah,
Silicon Knights is based in St. Catharines. Five blocks away from the office. No, it's about a street and a half over from where we are.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because St. Catharines is not that big.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but I only say that. As a sort of like lamenting thing, because I've played Metal Gear Solid on the PlayStation and I've played Twin Snakes. Twin Snakes is like Metal Gear Solid, the good version. Like it's the gameplay is way better. It's not as ridiculously punishingly difficult. It looks better. It feels better. Like it, you know, everything about it was good. They added the sort of the first person mode, like, everything about it was better.
Yeah.
There's a weird cutscene from Zone of the Enders inside there for some reason, and like posters about Zone of the Enders, and I love Zone of the Enders.
Like that's a tough call, right? Because like for some people, like the first person mode kind of broke the game, because it made certain things easier.
I'm of
two minds on that one, because I absolutely crushed the first PS1 version, like, so that is the game to me. I like Twin Snakes, don't get me wrong, but I am kind of glad they're going with the classic version, although I would also buy Twin Snakes separately if it was a Switch only thing for posterity. But I'm not sure what platform I'm gonna get this one on, but I am excited to have Metal Gear Solid back again, because I've been jonesing to play the first game again. I'm one of like probably five people alive that are like, is the VR missions in this the standalone thing, or is it just the standalone or the VR missions that were in Metal Gear 1?
Right.
Because there was the Metal Gear missions in the menu of Solid, and then there was the standalone game that they did. I'm really hoping it's the standalone game, but that feels kind of ambiguous to me still, whether it is that version or not.
I just really hope that Volume 2 finally gets MGS4 off the PS3.
Yeah, so...
Like, oh my god, I would love some way to play that.
I just want to talk quickly about the recent story about MGS4, where apparently it was running on the 360.
Yes, 360, yeah.
But, like, I've heard so many conflicting reports of that it just... Some of the way they did, like, the dual... later in the game when they did the dual scenes where, like, a cutscene was going on in real time and there'd be a battle going on in the other scene. You could like do things like they did some really dumb things in that game, but apparently that was only done in a way that the cell could do it. Or that's what Kojima said. So now I'm just like, well, how much of that is true?
Yeah. It's hard to know now. Yeah.
Or it could be that they did one of them when pre-rendered and the other one would be real if it was on the 360, whereas the PS3, it could do them both at the same time. It could have been something like that.
That's probably the case.
It physically could make it work. It just... one version would be different than the other kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That seems more likely,
It also seems like the kind of game that at that time Sony would have put some extra money forth to keep on PS3. Mm-hmm.
It's so funny, like you say that about those two scenes running in parallel. I play this game. I have no memory of it. It's just totally watching it.
It's like the climactic battle. You'll have like, I think with the battle with Vamp, the final battle with Vamp, it happens. And like when you're going into the reactor, I think maybe it's before the reactor, it does have something as well.
Is that because that scene where Snake crawls through like the microwave tunnel, I think that has that where he's crawling.
It does. And
you're seeing other stuff on top.
You're seeing like literally like battles going on outside as you're just like crawling for your life to get there type thing. Or when the old men are fighting on top of the airship.
Yeah.
That's no, the thing that happens.
Again, like because would that have anything to do with like the Blu-ray like capability?
They were saying was that it was running, but Kojima did not want it to be compromised. There would have been a few discs because the Xbox at the time was a standard DVD and MGS4 was almost a full Blu-ray. So it would have been like 4 to 5 discs.
Like Lost Odyssey.
Like,
Yeah.
That was the whole thing between the PlayStation 3 and the Xbox 360. Like they were essentially like their processors, their GPUs were more or less the same. It was just the PS3 could run Blu-rays and Xbox could.
No, that isn't exactly true. The cell processor could be more powerful if done properly, because the 360 was just a standard. It was a standard processor, but the PS3 was a weird custom thing that had, you could program the different cores to do different things at the same time or in parallel. I mean, apparently the PS3 was ridiculously hard to program for, but if it was done properly, it could do, that's how Drake's Deception, Uncharted 2 could work on that, where it could not work in the 360 in theory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I just remember hearing that was like the caveat, like they were more or less the same system, but like you said, because that was the whole thing with BioShock, right? They were supposed to come out simultaneously, but the team said it was like designing and programming it for the PS3 was like ludicrously hard, so they're like, whatever, we're just gonna do Xbox.
it was like the PS3 had, if you knew what you were doing, could be really powerful, much like the Dreamcast or the Saturn. Mm-hmm. All these systems that were kind of weird architectures, they weren't just off the shelf stuff, so you could technically make it more powerful or do more things with it, but it involved more time, and you needed to work closely with Sony to say, how does this work? And once you figure that out,
The Nintendo.
The same thing happened with Mass Effect, I think. Yeah. That's why that game didn't come to PS3 for so long, is because it was very hard to make a version for that.
Yeah, because I believe Unreal took a long time to come to PS. Unreal wasn't really optimized for the PS3 as well. It eventually got there, but it was never fully, like, if you had a PS3 game compared to an Xbox 360 that were both Unreal, the 360 would look better almost all the way, because they had a DirectX to work with, things like that, that just made it easier to program on. But yeah, the Blu-ray was the thing that this recent article or quote from a book outlined, that they had it running. The team said, yeah, we got it going. And then they're like, nah, it's going to be like 4 to 5 Blu-rays. We're not doing that.
Forget that.
But One thing that's interesting about the Metal Gear Solid Collection is that Snake's Revenge is included.
Oh my god! So yes,
Kojima does not have a hand in this, because he would not let that.
And the original Metal Gear, the NES Metal Gear.
I feel at this point Konami and Kojima are just at odds. So Konami's going to do whatever they want, and this is going to be like,
this is how you know he has no hand on the ball at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
just because they're doing something flagrantly.
In terms of legacy sake or like whatever, like, you know, it is a bit of weird Metal Gear history that you have sort of the actual Metal Gears, you know, that were made for the PC, and, you know, these weird offshoots that were not made by Kojima, like, even though he kind of accepts that they exist, you know, he said that they're not true Metal Gear games. You know, it's like that weird thing where, you know, like, you have the Japanese version of Metal Gear and the American version, the same way that you kind of have like the Japanese Super Mario and Super Mario 2, which was Doki Doki Panic, is referred to in Japan as Super Mario USA, like, because it was made specifically for dumb Americans.
I mean, I feel that there's a lot of things they could do with the Metal Gear series, but it's hard. These collections have a limit to what they can get up to. I mean, it's going to be hard to put in a Metal Gear Solid 4, Peace Walker maybe, but once you get past that, they're full discs in themselves.
Oh, sure.
So you can't. Mm-hmm. If Metal Gear Solid Collection 2 was just, here's 4, that's all we could fit.
They ain't going to put 5 on the Switch. What are you, mad?
people would be happy with just 4, I think. Yeah,
I'd be happy with 5. I want 5 on the new systems. I'm just throwing that out there. I would love to optimize 5 for the PS, like the PS5.
But in all reality, I think we kind of know that, like, the second volume would likely be, you know, if 4, probably all the PSP versions, like.
So I think you could get away with the Vision novels.
Yeah, it wouldn't be great, but I think you could get away with just doing 4 and Peace Walker for a second collection.
Those are
a little underwhelming compared to this.
There was Metal Gear Acid.
Oh yeah, that was weird.
That's right.
And Portable Ops was on there too.
That was fine.
That's the Peace Walker, the sort of like grid one.
I think Peace Walker was the best of the portable ones.
Oh yeah, by far. Yeah.
Like there's a solid storyline in that game. And there's some really interesting elements that I think you kind of see also in 5. They kind of took some of the elements they kind of saw in Peace Walker and brought them into 5.
Yeah, I think Peace Walker is like required reading if you want
to play 5. Honestly. It is a fantastic game. It really, really good game. I'm sad that it was so limited to where who could play that because wasn't it included in one of the collections later?
I don't know. It's so tangled up for a while.
Yeah, okay. Doesn't matter. Anyways, get back to Nintendo. I wanted to just touch on that because not had a chance.
Yeah, that was a neat story. So
I mean, aside from like all the other kind of stuff that was announced, you know, we got some interesting like JRPGs. There was the other really big story. There was the WarioWare that I'm kind of like I'm glad that they're better incorporating the Switch hardware into this one, but it does seem very like, I don't know, like one directional. I guess I'll have to see more because something I've always liked about WarioWare is not only its weirdness, but its big ensemble cast. And if this is just like, oh, Wario's stuck on a desert island and he's got to do a bunch of weird stuff, like, you know, I want to see Jimmy get involved. I want to see 9-volt and like all his friends.
The fact you know all that is so weird. Just so
you don't
weird.
Know all the various Mona, the journalist.
Nope.
There's
I don't.
There's who's the little girl living in the haunted mansion.
You can keep saying things I'm never going to remember.
Yeah. that was okay. Penny's Big Breakaway, the like cool looking yo-yo thing from the Sonic team. I'm really excited about that. And then I guess we did also get we talked about it briefly, but we didn't talk about the thing, or we talked about it extensively actually, but didn't talk about the thing that followed it. They're working on a Princess Peach video game.
Yeah, they teased that one.
I'm kind of excited to see how that's going to turn out.
Cool, and it seems maybe that they're going like a magical girl direction.
I mean,
which I think would be really cool.
That's fine. Yeah, because a lot of girls are gonna like. I know my niece is gonna eat that up. You know, she loves Princess Peach.
My daughter's gonna go to the moon for it. I'm just kind of curious what form it's gonna take because. I mean, if you look back at the last time Peach had her own game, it was all about how her out-of-control emotions gave her powers. And
That's a glib interpretation of it.
That's what it was.
I went back. I remember I revisited it a little while ago because I was the same way. I played it like when it came out, and I was very like douche bro high school guy that was like,
you please douche bro,
I don't want to play. Yeah, I know, I was the worst. No. Like, you know, and nobody wants to be like, oh, please, a girl cries and it's her bleh. Like, it's like, no, it actually was a pretty interesting game. It had a lot of good ideas. I think that they probably could have built on them a little bit better. But the idea that this all takes place on like a stage and it's sort of like a performance. I think you could, there's probably some cool stuff on it that you could do because again, it could kind of play almost like a little Big Planet in that sense where it has these sort of stagey levels and they're kind of platformy, but there's also like different things. Like we didn't really see, you know, at a certain point, it seemed like she was powering up to do something and we didn't really see how that was going to what that was going to culminate to. So
it's very much a tease. Yeah. They really didn't show. It's like it's almost uncharacteristic of them to tease that. Lately they've been like, here's our finished solid product.
Might have been a byproduct of how successful the Mario movie was.
Right.
Exactly.
Popular Princess Peach was in that movie, especially.
Yeah, people liked her.
Yeah, 100%. And everything they did with Peach was a good choice. So again, like giving her her own game, sort of like putting her front and center. Even in Super Mario RPG, like that was probably the first game where Peach was like, you know, aside from Mario 2, like a really active participant in the whole thing, right? Like even just like narratively, because it seems like it's playing out in the traditional Mario sense where she gets kidnapped and whatever, but then she actually becomes, you know, a member of the party and it turns out things like other things are at play. So they're really like making a big deal of her like being a main character in these games, right? I guess
I really like, hope they can. I really hope they can do the same thing with Zelda. Like Zelda really needs.
Yes. Game. Well, okay. I'll get into this in just a sec, but. So yeah, like aside from that, like seeing, you know, seeing like a lot of weird things. Number one, okay, first of all, I want to say this because Nintendo, don't waste my goddamn time during a direct with a fucking Splatfest announcement, please. Like that could have been an email. You know, it's like
you are getting angry. Like
because it made me angry. I was like, what is like why are you wasting my time with put it in the game? Who cares?
Because it's marketing for things. Why would
God
they not?
God damn it.
I mean, let's be clear.
It's a waste of time.
Every one of these showcases had some self-indulgent nonsense. Give it to Nintendo. Sure. You're allowed to have self-indulgent nonsense. Why not?
It's okay, but be self-indulgent.
It's the second bathroom break. I look right at the Just Dance commercial.
yeah, exactly.
I hear like, Just Dance and my eyes just glaze over.
Correct response.
Why are they making new separate things? Just... You're not even making cartridges.
It's Ubisoft. You know, Ubisoft is one step forward with a good looking princess or Prince of Persia, and then two steps.
Princess Persia.
There we go. It's all about girl power this episode. This whole direct.
Yeah,
this is all male podcast, all about girl power.
Yeah, that's right.
Dana, where are you?
Just please, just make one platform.
Just stop.
And well, I mean, if you're gonna do it, whatever. You know, there's a niche for it. Kids love it. Whatever. Have one title, sell the subscription that you're trying to push on people anyways, and just leave it at that. Stop wasting plastic on printing games so that only have a slip of paper
every single year.
Yeah.
It's just a waste.
Ubisoft's got to do it somehow.
Anyways. Yeah.
Can't do it with Assassin's Creed anymore, so they got to do it with Just Dance. And then, you know, I guess Arkham Asylum trilogy, that's kind of cool on Switch.
I mean, didn't they also release that on the Wii U at one point?
No, they did. They did Arkham.
Okay.
No, not City. Not Arkham City. I think it was Arkham Origin.
No, I think it was City.
It was Arkham City Armored Edition.
What it was called. It definitely was. I still have that disc.
But they did. They also did. I think they also did Origins on Switch or on Wii U, right?
No, I think that was 3DS.
No. No, they wouldn't have got on 3DS.
Blackgate, I think.
Blackgate.
That was a game.
I
don't know how Arkham Knight is going to run on the Switch.
No.
I don't know how Arkham Asylum is going to run on the Switch, if I'm being honest.
These are older games. I mean,
I'm really expecting that trailer it would end with cloud version.
Can someone explain what the cloud versions are? I've heard so many people, I have not really gone into
basically,
how they work comparatively.
Basically, the game is like loaded onto a server that Nintendo has. And
so similar like xCloud does, but
only for the Switch. So basically you're just using your Switch to access the game via a server. So it's like almost even like Google Stadia. Like it's just that's all you're doing, but it's really spotty connection. It's really not stable. And no, I don't think a single cloud version has come out that like outside of Japan that people have said that this is a running game worth playing.
You can't play it on the go either, right? Because it's like
it has to be connected to internet.
So that's half the point of the Switch is the portability. Like,
So
why the Kingdom Hearts cloud versions run terrible.
They're particularly bad. And Kingdom Hearts 1 could have just been a standalone thing. Even
most
two
of those games
are PS2 games.
Yeah.
I don't know why they would the cloud. Maybe it's cheaper. Just like, throw it in cloud works. We're done.
Lack of effort. Yeah. Because I mean, Square Enix also got Nier Automata working on the Switch pretty well.
Yeah.
That works really well.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's a weird one, but I guess we would be remiss to not mention the standout of the direct, and that was Vampire Survivors.
Zelda Amiibos. Ganondorf is an amiibo, and now we can all be thirsty for him for the comfort of our.
Yeah, I might just get that. Ganondorf. I might not even buy the game. I'll just get that Ganondorf amiibo and put it on my shelf and stare at it.
I will say I thought that amiibo announcement was leading up to like, and we're working on DLC.
I thought so too.
They are, for sure.
Right? Yeah, there's no way. I mean, probably the most successful game of the year. Like, I would imagine that's going to sell more than anything else.
Well, I mean, the year is still young, and we have what may be possibly the most interesting Mario game I have ever seen. on the horizon. Super Mario Wonder really got me. Like,
it looks pretty cool. It looked genuinely cool.
Smile ear to ear the entire trailer. Like,
very much agree.
I could not believe. And okay, so I know, you know, I am alone in this. Okay. Really? For as much as I love Breath of the Wild, mm-hmm. I will say that a couple of Nintendo's recent releases, not just with Zelda, but even like, you know, Splatoon, Kirby a little bit, although I feel this way. I know you guys don't. Or I don't know how Hayes feels. I know Chris doesn't. and I respect it. And I respect it.
Tenderhooks.
But it does, it has felt a little to me like Nintendo was playing it very safe with some of their releases. Like, they weren't really mm-hmm. advancing things too much. It was like, you know, we have what worked, you know, and it's, you know, a lot of the reason why I'm not jumping to play Tears of the Kingdom is because, like I said in previous podcasts, so much of the things that I didn't like about it didn't get fixed.
Right.
So to see a 2D Mario game that looks so weird, so unique, so like creative, has all these interesting ideas flowing through it, you know, the animation, the style, the fact that all, like, you know, Peach, Daisy, Yoshi, Toad, Mario, Luigi, everyone's in here, like,
mm-hmm.
that
don't
is
about Elephant Mario.
Elephant, yeah, Mario, like, what the hell? And I remember thinking when the Game Boy Online was released, and I was replaying Mario 2 and kind of like lamenting that, you know, Nintendo hasn't really done like a weird Mario in a long time. Like, Mario 2 on the Game Boy is a very weird game. Like, the areas, the enemies, everything about it is just bizarre for a Mario game.
Mm-hmm.
This feels to me like a return to that. Right. And I love it, because Mario and almost to the point where it almost really does feel like maybe they were influenced a little bit by the mm-hmm. Mario movie in that sense, because like
I don't think that's physically possible. Even if they started working on this the minute the Mario movie was done.
Well, okay.
The timeline doesn't match up. Like,
I guess that's fair. It just, a lot of it felt to me like even just like this, like the way, the style, the animation, everything that's going on. Like, it just, I don't know. It feels a lot more.
It is possible they were working on this when the Mario, yeah. And they said, hey, look at this. And they said, yeah, we're going to use some styling. I don't know why they were styling all of a sudden, but that's fine.
It would have been very easy for them to sort of like reuse sort of like, you know, old animations and spend mm-hmm. that kind of like style. But like the part where Mario goes into the pipe and his hat is like floating, and his little arm comes out to grab it and comes out, like, it's got this like rubber hosey feel. It's very cartoony. His little anime leg run, like, there's so much like going on visually that like I can't help but feel like maybe if there was any sort of like any kind of like outside media that influenced it, like, it does feel like, yeah, like it's a little bit anime, it's a little bit like cartoony, it's neat. God,
I was
damn,
gonna say, actually, like the biggest influence I saw on the trailer actually was Mario Maker. When,
you know what, yeah,
when he picks the Wonder Seed and things start moving, like the goalpost,
weird,
like goalpost moves, it's like, yeah, they were paying attention to Mario Maker all. They didn't make a Kaizo level, but you know, they're taking sub notes from it.
Now, I really love that part where it's like all shadows and the background is moving up and down, moving up and down.
Yeah. Oh my god. Oh. And so that's the, I love everything about what that game had going on. Like, I was like, I'm here for it 100%. The only like one thing that maybe made me worry a little bit. And it's, again, like, it's something I've talked about in the past, where Nintendo, in a lot of ways, when they have games like this and they have sort of like a central gimmick, they don't tend to make levels like they used to. And I feel like this is always sort of a little bit of bad game design, where you have a gimmick and you design a level around the gimmick, mm-hmm. sort of, instead of like making a solid level first and then finding sort of ways to work that gimmick in, you know. So I don't want, like, you know, I'm just hoping that maybe levels don't feel too like, okay, here's the Wonder Seed thing. Now, like, this is the way the level is. Like, it's very sort of like telegraphed. But that being said, it does kind of look like it might go in the other direction where things will get changed in such weird ways that you're never going to be expecting what's coming next. So I'm excited in that sense. And I like, yeah, I don't know. Again, I look at that and I think about my niece who, like, you know, you're introduced to Mario and she sort of loves playing it. Something I also noticed today too, just rewatching the trailer for the ninth time, there was no clock. So modern game design, if they sort of eliminate the like you know, archaic live system and a clock, like, this is going to be something that kids can really sink their teeth into because they have no you know, old school barriers to gameplay. Because that's one of the things, like I said, playing with my niece, because she loves Mario World, but I always tense up a little bit when we play it because she's not like the best at it, and she still sort of like runs around and she's trying to figure things out, and I'm always watching that clock counting down because she kind of wants to experiment and just move around and check things out,
right?
And I'm like, okay, but no, we have to get to the end of the level because we're both going to die if we don't, because that stupid clock. Like,
I know, I've been there with my daughter too. And while I was watching this trailer, I'm wondering, like, how's the multiplayer going to be? Because it's real hard to go back to Mario multiplayer on Switch after playing Kirby. Forgotten World and Return to Dreamland, they made it so easy to just hand a kid the remote and just have them play along with you. So I don't see a lot in the trailer that suggests that they've taken any notes from themselves on this one. So that's going to be a bit of a point for me on this one. I'm very excited to try it anyways, but I am very curious how they're going to do it. I really hope they took some notes.
I guess I like knowing sort of the trend of Mario games, I wouldn't be surprised if they included like a helper mode or, you know, the, like the gold Tanuki suit or something, like something that would give kids a little bit of an assistance.
Right.
But I'm hoping that it works in that way, the same way that old school Mario kind of worked, where it has a decent difficulty curve and it, you know, it's not super hard for kids, because like old school Mario 2 is, it's very easy to understand, right? So even though it's not as slow paced as something like Forgotten Land or even Return to Dream a little bit too, because to be fair, Kirby games are sort of fundamentally different from Mario games. So Mario is just naturally going to play a little bit faster than a Kirby game. But like, even comparing it to like 3D World, because 3D World is a little bit more like easy to sort of pick things up and understand and move around in 3D space and avoid obstacles and stuff. I guess to that point too, I'm hoping like that you can sort of give it to a kid and they can kind of start to figure things out.
To the point though, Mario feels more competitive than cooperative now by my comparison, because like Kirby makes it so it's very much like a teamwork thing and Mario is like, I'm playing with my daughter 3D World or whatever, and like I'm like, no, we got to get going, like, no, how are you, no, like you're wasting all the lives jumping off the platforms.
You know what's funny too is that, because even in the game, 3D World's a bad example because it even rewards you with a crown for whoever got the most points in the level. So when I play with my niece, she's always trying to like beat me for the crown, and then like when I naturally do better than her, that I'm trying to guide her through the level, she gets like upset that I'm always getting the crown.
Yeah,
but, you know, it's like, I mean, I'm not a total dick. I'll let her get the crown, you know, most of the time, but sometimes it's hard, right? I'm trying to help her.
They have to contribute to get it, and sometimes they're not contributing.
you gotta learn. It's like, but anyways. like what you're saying, I don't know, the general like feeling that I was getting from this trailer was this idea of like fun and like togetherness, and it didn't, like, the trailer doesn't make it look competitive. Like, not in the way that, like Mario, New Super Mario Bros. Wii, like, was genuinely competitive in that sense. This one feels a little bit more like it wants you to be like playing with friends, having a good time, working together. So,
It's fun, and it looks funny too. Like, yeah. I'm laughing at that trailer each time I watched it. Like,
yeah,
I like that. There's a little voice guy.
Yeah. So well, never mind.
Yeah. I'm interested to learn more about him.
Yeah, that's
very curious to see how it's going to play with those cartoon embellishments too. Right, like where he grabs the hat. Like, is that just part of the going into the tube animation? Is that going to like?
I really hope it is.
Very interesting to see more about that.
And that's what I was saying. And you know, Brendan, you're right. I guess for the timelines to line up in that way would probably be very inconceivable. But just the fact that there is a like vocal character using actual English in this, like, that's something I don't know if it would exist pre-Mario movie, you know what I
think
mean?
I think it is possible they worked in tandem, as in the Mario movie gave Nintendo some like early looks, and they've been like, oh, we could do some of that. I just don't think they could have waited till the movie's out.
No, 100%.
A game, because this game looks it's somewhat far along. So because
the only game that really attempted that, I guess, was Mario 64, and then Sunshine, and then everyone laughed at Sunshine, so they quickly stopped doing it.
Well, the thing is, like, people, like speaking of rumors and stuff like that, like, for the longest time, the rumors have been like, oh, the next Direct's going to have a Mario game for the holiday because the movie came out. Like, it's easy to say, they'll have a game to tie up, but like, it's not that easy to just slap a game together.
Oh,
like,
100%. Really
simple, but it's
still... Especially, I want to bring up the fact that, like, the Switch is easier to do than like the PS5 or the Series X NS, but it still takes time. Like, I know they were talking about at Summer Game Fest how the days when a game could be done in just 3 years are kind of over now, because the amount of people involved, the amount of time involved, and the amount of resources to make these games a reality is no longer possible to kind of slap that in a year. Like, even Call of Duty games need time. Yeah. So.
And
especially it's not something you can do quickly anymore.
Especially something like this that definitely does feel like it's been cooking for a while. I guess part of me felt that way too, just because Nintendo was so hands-on with the Mario movie, like, to make sure that it felt really good and suited their vision, that like maybe there had been some sort of like crossing of ideas and like bringing some things over. Right. Now that they have, I guess, maybe a better understanding of how to make a movie out of their properties, while they were working on it.
We also don't know how involved Nintendo is on their next system and like how many resources they're allocating to that.
True, 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 true.
So that could have an effect on both development time and the amount of releases that they're putting out.
100%.
That and there's things like, you know, people said that Fire Emblem Engage was done for 6 months to a year before it actually came out. So
apparently Engage started development around the same time Three Houses did.
Mm-hmm. Weird. Mm-hmm. So the pandemic still going to be shaking some things up. Maybe they've been holding on to this again because chances are they were going to do another system by now, and now they couldn't. So,
I mean, I think they decided not to. I think they physically could do another system. It's more the fact of they're worried about
waiting.
But
April next year, I think we'll have a different perspective.
I mean, honestly, like they need to. I think Switch hardware was good, but they're getting lapped now. Like they've fallen the same kind of problem they were in with the Wii, where the systems are just so much more powerful than what they're delivering that it just can't keep up. I think cell phone tech has come a long way. Like the Switch is based on cell phone tech. It's based on the Tegra processor. So the new NVIDIA chips are like light years more powerful than this one, that it could be almost the same form factor, be very compatible with old games and be almost as powerful as a PS4 compared to what this one is, kind of thing.
Yeah. We're pretty much at the time too, where Nintendo would typically put out a new system in terms of the length since Switch release.
Yeah, exactly.
That was one of the nice things about seeing Super Mario Wonder in this, because Tears of the Kingdom has kind of been talked about as like the last big game on the Switch, because we know that Pikmin 4 was coming and Metroid Prime presumably still exists, but there was a whole lot more on the radar.
I feel like Metroid Prime has to be the next system at this point.
That's what I'm saying.
I think it's got to be a launch or something, because I mean, but even then, who knows? Because they like the fact that they scrapped it from literally from like everything and started over,
totally restarted.
So who even knows?
That would have been right before the pandemic when they shifted their
plans. Exactly.
Yeah.
Stuff,
so. Yeah.
Either way, though, like it was nice to see that, you know, there is still something big coming for the Switch this year, and like a big cool note to go out on too.
Oh yeah, no,
something big and kind of charming like this.
It's definitely that thing too, because like Brendan was saying, you know, like when you look at the Switch technology or the Switch hardware, especially like now having a PlayStation 5 in my possession, like you definitely feel its age. Like, you know, I've been playing Miles Morales in performance ray trace mode,
right.
Like, holy shit, like that game works with that in that setting. To go from that, like a smooth 60 frames, you know, combined with the Miles Morales suit, so it looks even cooler with ray tracing turned on, and then the kind of like jump down to the Switch, like even with a game that I genuinely love, like Breath of the Wild, and you go into some of those areas and it drops to like 15 frames a second, and you're like, what is this?
Yeah.
It doesn't compare anymore, but it is definitely still good to see that Nintendo knows what to do in terms of like balancing their hardware with really creative, like genuine ideas. And that's what stands out. Like, because, you know, you're always going to have a lot of really good stuff from both the AAAs and even the indies, but it kind of feels like certain like Nintendo games are Nintendo games, right? Mm-hmm. No one's making Mario the way Nintendo's making Mario.
Definitely.
I agree with you 100%. Yeah.
Yeah, I think
we wrap up there then.
Then that is my final point.
Yeah,
that's cool. sounds good. Does everyone? Let's start with giving everyone socials. Chris, what is your social media stuff?
You can find me on Twitter at Hoogathy. It's pretty much the main place. And if you happen to be listening and going to be in the London area this weekend, I'm going to be at the Forest City Comic Con doing a panel on Return of the Jedi on Saturday afternoon. So check that out.
Hayes, where can people find you?
So you can find me on Twitter at SoulFleet. It's S-O-L Fleet. So that's generally where I put most of my stuff.
Awesome.
If anyone is interested in Final Fantasy 16, I'm going to have stuff going up on Inverse, on Kotaku, so on CG Mag, on Twinfinite. So
you're all over the place.
Hitting that game pretty hard. Yeah.
Awesome. Jordan, where can people find you?
Well, as you know, I don't really do the socials anymore because I'm an old grumpy man and technology scares me.
And you say dumb things.
But sometimes I will post the odd drawing on Instagram, and sometimes I post the odd video on TikTok at NinjaXJordan. And even though I'm not wearing my iconic hat, you can find me at Ninja Jordan Reviews on YouTube.
And I am BFry26 on everything because I'm lazy and unoriginal. Thank you for listening. You can follow CG Magazine at CG Mag Online on Twitter and TikTok and Instagram, etc. You can find all the things we talked about on cgmagonline.com. And you can also listen to this on Spotify if you have not. I don't know if you can come on Spotify, but those are things. Like it and follow it, and that helps us out. So,
and reviews.
From everyone here, reviews are great. From everyone here at CG Magazine, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.